You're listening to The Entrepreneurs with me, Daniel Bage. This week, we're off to Los Angeles to meet Morgan McLaughlin, head distiller and chief product officer for Amass, a premium botanical spirits brand. Morgan grew up in British Columbia, Canada, and had a deep connection to the natural world and local plant life. She started her career in film and television as a camera operator, and later, while living in LA, got interested in distilling. The range of spirits, hard seltzers, and personal care products made now by Amass are in many ways a celebration of the terroir of Morgan's home in California. Here now is my conversation with Morgan McLaughlin on the story of Amass, with some excellent insight on how the spirits and drinks world is changing and how our palates are changing too.
Amass is I like to think of it as a 21st century botanics based, at this point, lifestyle brand. We are primarily focused in the drinks business. We have a portfolio of beverages that are all focused on celebrating botanics across all sorts of beverage categories. So we have spirits, we have gin and vodka, and we have a line of hard seltzers that we launched this year, as well as non-alcoholic products. And we're expanding that side of our portfolio even farther. We also actually have sort of a number of personal care items in our portfolio as well that are all botanically focused, as well as home fragrance. So the concept of this company has evolved and it's kind of turned into sort of an omni-category, omni-channel business. 2 years ago, we were really trying to start as more of an independent and innovative but traditional spirits portfolio. We developed this thesis around really the concept of biophilia, the celebration and connection and love of nature, and focusing rather than, you know, just following all of the same liquor categories that frankly have been around for hundreds of years and there's been very little disintermediation. The liquor industry is super traditional and, in my opinion, very boring in a lot of ways, and focusing on botanicals as opposed to traditional liquor categories and exploring botanicals in the mediums of beverage. And then we got a little excited about botanicals and their fragrance application and also their functional application. And we moved into completely different product categories. So we have lotion, we have candles, things like that, that are all focused on botanical fragrance.
Super interesting and lots in there. I can understand the different applications and the interest in moving into different, personal care products, fragrance, as you've said. But you did start in the spirit side of things. Talk to me about your interest in botanicals and where that began.
So, well, you are a fellow Canadian. I grew up in British Columbia and really kind of in the wilderness. And so took up an interest in the natural world at a very young age. And that was always just kind of a hobby of mine. I kind of grew up in a bit of a hippie, witchy community. So, you know, plant-based medicine and understanding of the symbolic and medicinal qualities of plants around me was something I was exposed to from an early age. And then when I moved to Southern California, I was in a completely different terroir with all sorts of plants, whether they're indigenous or in the case of Los Angeles, there's incredibly diverse flora that grows here that is both indigenous and imported. It's sort of a wild mishmash. And, you know, and didn't know anything about it and decided, let's have fun. Let's learn about all of these plants and trees. And so it was really just sort of a romance with botanicals. I'm not a botanist by trade. I just really, really have a passion for plants. And when I started distilling, it really started as a question, which was historically, at least in spirits, you know, the local distillates and distillates tend to be very regional around the world. The local distillates are traditionally made out of whatever there's an agricultural excess of in the area. So in the case of Mexico, it's agaves, you know, tequila and mezcal. In the case of America, and there's various reasons for this, most of our spirits are made out of corn. And because corn is grown everywhere and it's highly subsidized and the United States is all about corn and corn is in everything and we're basically made out of corn. Scotland, of course, you're talking more about malts, beverages, just whatever grows locally. So here I am in Southern California and none of these things grow locally. And I was thinking, what would a Southern California spirit be made of? And I thought, it would of course, be made out of citrus, which isn't indigenous, but we aren't, when people, I think in the world's cultural imagination of California, people think of citrus just started as an experiment. I decided to build a still. This is the part that I have to be kind of subtle about when I'm on doing interviews, because home distilling is illegal and is still illegal in the United States. I kind of took the technical knowledge that I had from being a camera woman, and I built a still, and I started distilling in my Hollywood bathtub.
I, as a Canadian, I'll patiently wait for the grain-based rye whiskey that you're going to do some days. And you do have a non-alcoholic spirit distilled in British Columbia, which is very interesting. But I'm so fascinated by how you describe the local terroir, and a creative will be very interested in sort of the tools that they have. And I guess that started with sort of bathtub gin as you're setting out. But how did you progress in that career as a distiller? And what was your sort of interest in doing that more professionally or commercially?
The interesting crossover between my previous profession as a camera woman and distilling is both of those, they're very male dominated industries, which is a different story. But both of those professions, they're quite romanticized, but they're really trades. And there's a lot of technical knowledge and there's a lot of craft, but there's also a lot of artistry. So I wasn't intimidated about honestly teaching myself how to distill, because I'd already taught myself how to work with every single motion picture camera. And at the time when I was teaching myself, this is about 15 years ago, there's really no place to study it. To my knowledge, you know, there's I believe a school in Edinburgh where you can get a university degree in distilling sciences. And there's like a couple of little seminars you can take here in the States, but there was really nowhere to study it. So I started just going to the library and taking out books and looking on the internet. And there are some, you know, very rustic forums for home distillers on the internet, and started teaching myself. And it's just distilling is one of those things, like any trade or any art form, you just have to do it. And it's a lot of work. You have to do it and do it and do it and do it over again. And so I was just sort of doing it and just sort of got passionate about it. It started as a hobby. I was distilling all sorts of things that I could get my hands on, both traditional spirit styles and then, you know, for example, making eau de vie out of mandarins, or seeing what it would taste like distilling tomatoes, or making very weirdo gins of locally foraged botanicals. So just doing it as for fun, sharing the spirits, and people actually really love them. And then at the time I thought, well, there's no one doing this. You're in LA, really. So why not build a distillery? And that was, you know, so that was really my first foray into fundraising and running a business. I come from a family of artists, and I, you know, it wasn't like I had at that time really access to any person who, for example, knew how to build a financial model. So it was quite a learning process, but discovered I actually really love it.
So interesting. And I'm curious how you sort of took to that world of business. I can understand coming from a family of artists, as you say, and as being a creative person, you understand sort of the creation part of it and will have enjoyed the experimentation in creating something that you wanted to share. But how was getting into the business side of things?
I loved it. I think I actually really love crunching numbers, and it was a wonderful education. When you're fundraising, you really have to have an answer to all of the diligence questions, and it's really scary. You're dealing with other people's money. It was those first few years when I was fundraising and then building out and managing my distillery. I mean, there's a lot of anxiety and tension, but for me, I consider myself an artist, and I come from a family of artists, but I love business. I love being an entrepreneur. I love crunching numbers. I love building financial models. I love projections. And so it was intimidating at first, but then I just made myself get really familiar. I didn't really outsource much of, especially the finance work. And I'm very grateful for that, because that really forced me to get an intimate understanding of not just my business, but business principles in general. And I feel very comfortable there. And so my advice to my letter to young artists who are interested in business is, don't be intimidated. Business is actually a very, very creative field. And I feel much more creatively fulfilled as an entrepreneur than I did as a filmmaker.
Super interesting. And that is a great little piece of advice and encouragement there. Let's talk a little bit about the products that you do have. I mentioned the non-alcoholic spirit that is distilled in British Columbia. But talk to me about where you started. There's a dry gin as well, which is more on the botanical side, as we've talked about, vodka as well, and those hard seltzers. But what were the products you launched with, and how have you moved on in growing the range?
So it's funny, with the distillery, my first business, I mass started as a client. So I became known for developing alcohol liquor products, and Amass is actually the fourth gin that I've developed for other brands. And we launched with a gin. We took the gin to market about maybe 2.5 or 3 years ago. So launched with the gin, we wanted it to be complex and nuanced and certainly unique, as 29 botanicals in it, which is a lot. And conceptually there, we wanted it to be a Los Angeles gin, which I think for gin lovers around the world creates a little bit of cognitive dissonance, because you don't think of LA being a particularly botanical city necessarily, and Los Angeles couldn't be more opposite than London in so many regards. And so that was why we wanted to do it. It was really fun. So the botanicals in this gin, we used some traditional gin botanicals, but really a lot of indigenous California botanicals. And then also herbs and spices really coming from the different culinary traditions around Los Angeles. LA, it's starting to become more of a city known for its food, but it's not known for its white tablecloths. It's known more for just sort of the amazing sort of mom and pop ethnic foods around the city. And it's like London, a very multicultural city. And so we wanted to celebrate that aspect of LA, not just the physical landscape and the physical terroir, but the cultural landscape of the city as well. So we launched with that product, and then we launched with the vodka that has a subtle amount of botanicals added to it. We actually added, it's not a flavored vodka per se, but we decided to, rather than using certain additives that are very commonly used in the liquor industry that are not disclosed on the label to soften the mouthfeel of the vodka and give it some nice structure, we actually use botanicals to do that. So we experimented with a number of different botanicals and came up with the idea of adding just three botanicals, lemon, marigold, and chamomile, to give it a little bit more structure and a little bit of a softer mouthfeel. After that, we added our hard seltzers, which again, I'd never tasted a hard seltzer before we decided to experiment with making one. The category was not exactly the most sophisticated category, and the thought of drinking one just wasn't very appealing to me. We actually decided to develop them shortly after I'd had a baby. And so I went from never having tasted a hard seltzer to tasting every single one that was in the market. And our hard seltzers, we have three flavors at the moment. We're launching a couple more. One's called Sunshine, one's called Fairy Fizz, and one's called Surferoso, which is a nod to the Pixies, who are a favorite, actually, of not just me, but our brand manager. My joke with our products is it's minimalist on the outside and maximalist on the inside. So we focus on transparency. We use a lot of ingredients, but they're all good for you, better for you ingredients. And so our hard seltzers are, you know, they're much more complex. We're not going after like the fraternity market. We're going after people who just want to have a drink after work that is nice and celebratory and nuanced, but they don't want to open a whole bottle of wine. And we've actually found they've been doing really, really well. They've gotten lots of awards. So that was a very funny thing, because I never thought I would make something like that, but they're actually really delightful.
I'm curious about the brand and the actual look of it, and how you tell the story about the botanicals. I love the look, a simple typeface, the colors that you've gone with, black and white, and very simple shades, not sort of bold and in your face. Talk to me about that and how you wanted to help showcase the brand.
I guess in general, like when I think about where we see ourselves, specifically the beverage market, our products are technically speaking are in the what's called the super premium category. So they are luxury products in a way. So the packaging certainly needed to be luxury. Now, as you know, especially in liquor, there's a lot of, I won't say kitsch, but there's a lot of liquor brands draw on a lot of oldie timey aesthetics to give their brand a certain gravitas. And the fact of the matter is, we're not an incumbent brand. We're not Bushmills. We haven't been around for 400 years. We're not Remy. Our brand, we're not drawing on our legacy or tradition. We are a decidedly modern brand. And so we wanted that to be reflected in the aesthetics of our bottle. And I think, too, my particular like take on the beverage market in general is that in the approach, like in the product philosophy, is I really want to create products for the modern bar cart. Alcohol categories are so tradition bound, and they have their rules and regulations and stylistic conventions that really, if you get into the history, exist not because malted barley tastes really good. There's usually socio-historic, economic, or environmental reasons for why historical beverage categories taste the way they do. So we're kind of questioning those conventions and thinking, what does a modern drinker really want to taste and experience? You know, people's palates are so much more sophisticated and people are so much more interested in what they're consuming, and they want to know what they're putting in their body, and they want to know where the sugar cane comes from that's in their rum, and they're interested in developing their palates, and they expect delightful, novel, pleasurable drinking experiences. And I'm not saying that traditional alcohol isn't that, but I think there's just a lot of room for something new. People's lifestyles have changed, but like the drinks industry, I think, is kind of racing to catch up.
This has been so fascinating, Morgan. It's wonderful to speak to a Canadian, and hopefully we can check in with you again soon.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Morgan McLaughlin, their head distiller of Amass. You can learn more about their products and read more about Morgan's approach to distilling and working with natural ingredients at amass.com.
Dubai Tourism is proud to partner with the entrepreneurs on Monocle 24. Dubai is one of the most dynamic and innovative cities on the planet in which to do business, and a place where you can enjoy unrivaled quality of life. Dubai should be your destination, whether you're looking to start a new venture or take your career to the next level. Janis Rostock is an award-winning architect, urban designer, and master planner who was the lead architect for the Dubai Opera, the contemporary concert hall that pays tribute to Dubai's maritime history. Rostock says the city is a celebration of diversity and heritage with an infectious excitement for the future.
The best part of living and working in Dubai is the fact that the work we're doing here is impacting the many. As a master planner and urban designer, you rarely get to see the projects you've designed being realized because it usually takes 20 to 30 years. Here, on the other hand, you've got projects that I've designed 5, 10 years ago that are now starting to be completed. So it's literally like a lab. You draw a line and they build it outside the window. It's incredibly rewarding.
Architect and master planner Janis Rostock. Dubai, the future of business is here.
You're listening to The Entrepreneurs with me, Daniel Bage. Next up on today's episode, let's talk about fundraising. It's a vital but often stressful part of growing any business. And there are plenty of different routes to go down, from venture capital to taking out a bank loan and even crowdfunding. Another booming sector of the fundraising world is revenue-based financing, where investors back growing companies for a fixed percentage of their revenue. For some insight now on how to navigate this world, I sat down with Michelle Romano, the co-founder and president of Clearco, said to be the largest e-commerce investor in the world. To date, they've invested more than $2 billion U.S. dollars in 5,500 companies globally. Using data and AI, Clearco has also created a way to finance startups more quickly and is using their platform to remove bias in where their money goes, with the aim of supporting a more diverse range of founders. Michelle is also a dragon on CBC television show Dragon's Den and very used to ideas being pitched to her in person. So I was curious to hear about how data mixes with the more human side of doing business.
Before we existed, there was really two options for founders, right? Whether you were a small business or you wanted to grow at 100 times a year. It was either, you know, you go to a bank and you take out a personal guarantee, which means that if you didn't pay that money back, the bank got it and the bank got your personal assets. or you went the route of trying to look for equity investors. And that meant, you know, 3 to 6 months of pitching, 100 different pitches, lots of no's along the way to hopefully sell a piece of your company that you would never get back. Hmm. And one of the things that we started, you know, 5 years ago was this idea that founders should be able to get money in a third way, which is this idea of revenue sharing. So we would give you, say you're looking for $100,000 of startup investment. We would give you that $100,000. And instead of taking 10% of your company that we would own forever, we would take 10% of your revenue just until you paid us back our capital plus 6%. And in the early days, everyone thought this was a loan. They were like, oh, well, isn't that the same thing? And it's not, because first of all, we had no personal guarantee. We had no fixed payment timeline. We had no compounding interest. And most importantly, if you didn't pay Clearco back, we didn't take your company. Like, it didn't sit as debt on the business. And so what's crazy to think is, you know, now in the last 2.5 years, you know, we've invested more than $2.5 billion in almost 6,000 different founders. So 700 of those are in the UK today. And we've built this entire industry around revenue share. And so we've seen lots of people pop up around the globe that are effectively doing the same thing. And so your options are way wider than they ever used to be in terms of building a business. And then I think on top of that, COVID made it so much easier to start a business because customers want to be buying from small businesses today. They don't want to be buying from massive retail chains.
How does that benefit the small businesses then, using this revenue share model compared to, let's say, traditional VC? Because as I said, a lot of people will be looking at that and seeing headlines and thinking, oh, this is a good ticket to fast growth. And that is... That is good for some businesses,
totally.
But how does this help the business owner in working with you and having that type of partnership?
So ultimately, I believe it's the founder that does all the work. And so the founder should own majority of the business. You know, I've had to work with VCs for a number of years, but the reality is that you're doing all the work as the founder. And so when you give up equity, you don't get that back. But giving up control is even harder. Mm-hmm. Because even if you are an incredible founder, I mean, I look at my board, they meet with me 4 times a year, right? Even if I give them a perfect board document and all the information, I mean, they have probably 1/100,000th of the data that I have as a day-to-day operator in the business. I always say, like, choosing a VC is like marriage without sex. There is, you know, it's a very difficult divorce if you want to do that. And you are in this on a very long-term basis. So it's important to choose incredibly wisely, because there's lots of stories where, you know, VCs will force growth that is unnatural. And at the end of the day, the founder should be building the company that they want to build. And so, you know, we've spent a lot of time being very hands-off with our founders. We don't tell founders what to do with their money or how to spend our money, but we certainly give them advice if they want that. We have a whole group within our company that helps you sell your company if that's something you want to do, because we realized all of the private equity firms and e-commerce roll-ups were coming to us being like, can you help us source companies? And we're like, well, we actually have people that probably want to be sold. And so it's not that we can't help you. It's just that we genuinely believe that the founder probably knows what's best for the business.
Tell me about how you find the right companies that work for Clearco,
because
you're working with data, which is very interesting. Obviously, you're going to pick and choose what works for your portfolio and what you think is going to be successful. So let's talk a little bit about how you find those businesses and how businesses can make themselves attractive to people that want to invest.
Totally. So, you know, we fund businesses that are e-commerce businesses that are in the mobile apps space or B2B SaaS companies. So largely digital businesses that have a minimum of $10,000 in monthly revenue. So you can still be really small and come to us and get capital. We'll invest anywhere from 10,000 all the way up to 10 million pounds in a single business. And how do you make yourself attractive? I mean, this is an important part of the story. So for us, what we care about is that you have positive unit economics. So that means that if you're selling $100 basket size off your website after the cost of sale of your item and the cost of ads, you're still making money. This is good discipline, whether you want our capital or anyone's capital. That means you're running a business that can grow and scale. That doesn't mean necessarily you're profitable. You could still be investing in product development and staff and other things that are making you unprofitable, but at least on a unit economic basis, you're profitable. We care about your growth rate, and we care about if you've penetrated your audience sizes and a bunch of different data that we're looking at in a really automated way. The other thing about looking at automated data that was so fascinating to us, and we started this because we just wanted to be faster. We're like, if we use humans to look at all these deals, we're going to go very slow. But so that's why we built all of this AI to look at these. But when we looked back at our portfolio, it was actually crazy to see what our portfolio looked like. I mean, we had backed 30% of our founders in the UK are women, which I love. 70% of our founders live outside of London in the UK. And so we're seeing way more diversity than we typically could. That's what we care about when we invest. I think if I'm going to give more general advice on what VCs care about, they care about, and the threshold is very different. You have to deeply understand what the venture capital model is. It is truly based on exponential growth, which means that in 10 companies they invest in, 7 of those will fail, 1 will do okay, and 2 will just grow at, you know, 100 or 200 times their size. And so their minimum threshold is looking for a company that could potentially 10x by the end of a certain year. So thinking of even the possibility of a 10x is really massive. And so what you want to do in your pitch is paint the story of how that's possible that that could happen and what's driving your growth rate beyond just your acquisition cost and just putting in paid ad spend and what the future is going to like. And I know that seems, you know, a little bit wishy-washy, but effectively you have to be painting a very, very big story to be attractive to venture capitalists. And then you have to commit to doing that because it is just the way the model works is that they need companies that have that potential.
It almost sounds a little bit like a Moneyball way of doing things. It's a bit data analytics heavy, we can say, and how you're making decisions and guiding next
steps.
It's exactly Moneyball. And not to use a sports analogy, but I'm just curious about how you then put the human side of these relationships together and how you grow businesses. Because if you're making decisions based on all of this data and numbers, how do you maintain those relationships and how do you grow? Because obviously you're making choices and this is you helping grow the businesses that you want to see grow.
Exactly. I have not heard the Moneyball analogy, but I absolutely love it because it is that. And remember, we're making the decision on how much to invest based on Moneyball. And then we're making some recommendations on what the business should do based on a lot of data. So think about the difference in our data set versus a VC's. A VC might know 20 of their portfolio companies really well, but wouldn't know something like, I don't know, which vendor they're using for email service provider, or they wouldn't know something as detailed as that. Whereas if you look at the ClearCo portfolio, we have 40,000 companies connected to ClearCo. So I'm seeing things as detailed as like this month, it's actually time to buy TikTok ads. It's not time to buy Facebook ads because they're actually performing a lot better on a massive sample size. That could actually change week 2 of November, but I'll let my founders know that because that's the power when you have a lot of data and you're set to do that. But your question is a really good one, which is that, okay, can you do everything automated? And the answer is absolutely not. We make the decision on how much money to put in on a completely automated basis. But then everyone has their own associate at ClearCo. And typically, our associates manage, you know, about 50 companies each. And so they connect those founders. They then have a very personalized approach in terms of when they need more capital, who we can connect them with, other people on our team. And so that part is still very, very human touch-based because I wouldn't know a way to take the human out of that.
Last question to you. I am so curious about how this will change the world of investment, what you are doing and the rate of growth that you've been able to grow ClearCo, as you've said. How will this change the traditional world of VCs and the world of people knocking on the door of the bank?
So if we think about it this way, like in the last 2 years, we've put out $2.5 billion. The entire venture capital industry is $23 billion. So the fact that we could even be itching at like 10% of an industry already is mind-blowing to me. Like, it's really exciting. And I think about there are so many more founders that are overlooked. Like, our product works really well if you've raised venture capital. Because if you think about it, great, raise $5 million from VCs, raise $5 million from ClearCo, use our money for your ads and inventory. You don't have to take the additional dilution. We have, you know, lots of those companies in our portfolio. But we also have lots of companies in our portfolio that weren't from the right circles, that didn't go to probably the right schools. When even the language we use to talk about where you raise money from, your friends and family round, like, it's pretty elitist to think your friends and family have 10,000, 50,000 pounds to just throw you to start a business, right? So we see this in our portfolio all the time, you know, single Black mothers, ex-military veterans, people that have genuinely built extraordinary businesses with great data, but we're not a part of this ecosystem. And so I think about all of those businesses that we're going to see, how different those are, and, you know, get very, very excited about what that world could potentially look like. Because I don't think it's just us stealing market share from banks or us stealing market share from VCs. I think there's a whole brand new group of people that will be much bigger founders than we ever thought.
Very well said. And I can't say how wonderful it is to have you here in studio, Michelle. So do come back soon, please.
I would love to.
Michelle Romano, president of ClearCo and co-host of CBC television show Dragon's Den. You can learn more at clear.co. And do have a listen back to my full interview with Michelle from earlier this year on her career. That's on episode 490 of The Entrepreneurs. That's it for this week. My thanks to Jack Jewers, who mixed and edited this show. I'm Daniel Bache. Thank you so much for listening, and goodbye.